So I've been asked to discourse on one slogan, which is seeing confusion as the four kayas is the supreme shunyata protection. Emily's transferring the ox's load to me.
Wait, it's more than one slogan. It's three.
Well, I'm focusing on that.
Okay.
But there's a context.
Don't forget. Keep to the program.
Oh, it's going to be a tough... It's a tough crowd anyway.
It's just me. I'm obnoxious.
No, it's not just you. So we're going to talk in general. To talk about the slogans in point three, we have to talk about point three. And point three makes no sense unless we talk about point two.
Oh.
And point three is carrying or transforming all kinds of problems onto the path. The previous point, however, it sort of sets the stage, it gives the aspiration, it gives the guidelines, because in point two, we're developing bodhicitta, enlightened mind, awakened heart, what have you, which have both relative and absolute aspects. The absolute aspect has to do with the nature of reality, unfiltered by our own concepts or pretensions or thinking, thoughts about it. And how do we tune in to what things are as how things are as they are? And we find that we can do that through examining the flurry of mind and seeing how mind is empty but radiant and has its power to know things. Know all kinds of things. But there's also relative, which is our need, seeing how confused we and others are, seeing that sanity is possible, we want to bring sanity to others. However, we cannot do that unless we are much more sane ourselves. So we aspire to develop sanity. And we desire to be less self-involved and much more open and much more expansive. We can call it spacious. And it's very inspiring. And Mahayana begins by being very inspiring. You look at the way of the Bodhisattva, chapter 3, where you're taking the Bodhisattva vows, and you can almost hear the choir in back of you. Then there's the next chapter, which is, what the hell did I just say? What did I do? It's like waking up after a really good party and hoping you didn't make a fool of yourself. And that's pretty much what the Mahayana path is. And point four of the Lojong slogans is about that transition from the inspiration to really the hard work, to the working with situations as they arise, working with all situations as they arise. And I know, I've gotten better over a long time. But it used to be that my practice was going very well when life was going well. When life wasn't going well, my practice sort of went down the tubes. And later, I would always say, you know, why didn't you keep practicing? You could have gotten something from this. Well, point three is about that. So it's divided into different sections. The first is a general statement, which reads, when the world is filled with evil, transform all mishaps onto the path of Bodhi.
There's some more copy.
This is not like abundance theology. This is not like I have a very Christian client who says that, you know, if you have faith, God will grant you your prayers. And if he doesn't grant your prayers, it's because you're not praying in the right way. That's not this. Not only do we expect difficulties to occur, but we kind of look for it. We kind of take advantage of it.
Sounds Jewish.
Sounds Jewish.
Oh, not quite Jewish.
Oy
vey. Oy vey.
It's Jewish.
Well, I think that's a big difference.
Yes.
Prior to this, we're actually just trying to escape difficulty.
Exactly.
And the Mahayana path is really encourages us to actually look for them, take them on.
It's the Mahayana path affirms life. The good stuff, the not good stuff. Everything is possible. So the point here is not to discourage, but to encourage our practice. Linda.
I have not read this section. And I've been thinking on this bad circumstances one a lot, though, in my own practice. And when the world is filled with evil, it's so external, and I wonder, so much of the suffering is coming from your own ego and your own thoughts. And I can't find anything in here that says that in point three. Or am I? I know drive all blames into one, but I mean the when the world is filled with the mishaps. Some of the mishaps are your own making.
Sure.
So
sure, but we're not discriminating between the mishaps that are your own making and the mishaps that just occur to you.
All right. So
we're taking the whole
thing. We're taking the whole thing.
We're not even analyzing it. Because there's the idea of karma, which is on some level, all of our suffering is a ripening of something.
Right.
So we're not going to...
Because whatever you meet unexpectedly can also be yourself. Your ego.
Big time.
That's, you know,
oh, yeah.
That's
we often meet ourselves unexpectedly. Absolutely. This is whoa. Me? Oh, no.
I was just looking for a line that was a little more pointing in that direction.
Well,
some of the lines sort of...
However, as we begin to... Then we do the relative. Two of our favorites. Two of the best known slogans of all the 59, which is drive all blames into one. It doesn't mean your partner. It means you. And... and be grateful to everyone, or remember the kindness of everyone. It's read in different ways. And as you have experienced trying that out, it can be very disconcerting because it flies face in our habitual patterns of trying to save face, maybe trying to save face with ourselves. Sometimes we're okay. You know, we're not so concerned about other people thinking less of us, but our self-esteem goes down.
Oh.
It happens. Not just you. And, of course, be grateful to everyone flies in the face of our tendency to divide the world into friends and enemies. People we like, people we don't like. And... that's a trap, because we know how cozy and stupid we can get when we're just surrounded by people we like. And we can play mightily, but it's really good for us to hang out with people who don't like us or we don't like. It keeps us sharp. So those are relative, and relative simply means we're working with situations in life. But, Linda, here's your chance. We're going to look in, okay? The absolute is how we work with ourselves, okay? And they're inseparable. So I like to, as my friends all know, I like to take things like phrase by phrase and sort of take it out. So... let's start. So there is seeing confusion as the four kayas is supreme shunyata protection. All right? That's the absolute. That will be followed by four things that you can do, procedures, techniques, and a summary, which is whatever you meet should be joined, immediately joined with meditation. So whatever means whatever. And not the whatever stuff that makes us feel better. So this is, you know, actually, Trungpa Rinpoche used to love to talk about the oy vey attitude. And, you know, it's like, he actually had a lot of respect for it, but very much a sense of humor about it. Trying to say that Mahayana is not quite that. But it's a part of it. So, seeing confusion. Question. Do we see confusion? Sometimes, sometimes not. What's your experience of confusion? Why do we use the word confusion here? All the translations use the word confusion. So, what's confusion?
Lack of clarity.
Okay. How does that feel? What does it feel like when you're confused?
Murky.
Scared.
Uncertain.
You don't know what to do.
You don't know what to do. How come you don't know what to do?
Because you don't have the sense of, like, that's the way to go, or this is, because you're not even sure what's there.
Uh-huh.
I can go this way and I don't know what's there, and I can go this way and I don't know what's going to be there.
Yes.
And I can't figure it out.
My favorite Far Side cartoon, there's two doors and the devil in between. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. Anyone else? What's confusion to you? We all experience confusion.
I'm thinking of it sort of, I thought I had my trip together and it just gets blown out.
You know,
it's obvious that it's not working. Whatever thought I had about having a handle on whatever was going on just proved to be wrong.
Down the tubes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we like confusion?
No.
Not particularly. No. In some ways, we like to stay stupid. Because we like to be sure. We like to know what we're doing, even if it's wrong. Which is the other part of confusion. Has it ever happened to you that you knew exactly what you were doing and said, boy, I was pretty confused about that?
You mean in retrospect?
Retrospectively, yeah. The next day or the next month, it's like, what was I thinking? And we began to appreciate that we were confused.
A lot.
Oh, so it's quite pervasive in our experience when we actually, like, think about it. I'll bet you that in your hour or so of meditation this evening, you experienced a little confusion. You know, just maybe a little bit. So, what's confusion? There are two ingredients of confusion, which you pretty much said. One is sort of the emotional part. Sometimes it's called afflictive emotions, sometimes conflicting emotions. It's when we're being pulled in different directions emotionally. I want to do this, but I know I can't do that. But I should do this, but I don't want to do it. I really like doing that, but that's not going to work out. All right? We get pulled in different directions. And there's also a phrase from Herbert Gunter, primitive beliefs about reality. I just love that phrase.
I love that too. What does it mean by that?
I'm going to tell you. Primitive belief is, we actually think that things last, they stay forever, that they're not caused, they're just sort of there, that everything can be looked at concretely and literally and solidly, that there's really no fluidity in the universe, and that there's me. That's a primitive belief about reality. There's me that I have to spend my entire life protecting and defending and conquering and all right, these are primitive beliefs. So you put both of them together, the conflicting emotions, primitive beliefs, and we have just what you say. It's like, I'm here, I'm there, I don't know what to do. Now, we're confused much of the time doing our life, and we don't notice it. When do we notice our confusion? When shit happens. We notice our confusion. Therefore, we want shit to happen, because we can notice our confusion that way. It's very simple.
You could try meditating.
Well, yes. One could try. So what you do is you corner yourself into some experience of suffering. Sometimes it's called meditation. Sometimes it's called just letting things stir up. Sometimes people will go in the direction of something that gets them stirred up as a means to work with their mind. Mm-hmm. What? There are certain meditations where you actually do that. You think of somebody you're really jealous of or really envious about, or you're really pissed off with, and you kind of you actually focus on that, on the whole physical dimension of that, and you look at your mind.
Now, I was more thinking of the work I do with this group of kids who are really challenging, and I'm thinking like, if I didn't go there, I wouldn't have to see so much.
Like, yeah, well, maybe it's good that you do that work.
Maybe.
You know, you want to go into, do not want to go into situations that are too cozy. You want to go into situations that kind of are a little edgy. I think joining a Dharma group is a good start sometimes. Writing one is especially good start. Yeah, I like to, Trump has one of his aides named Stephen Miller. Oh, yeah. Every time I see him, it's not just me. Okay.
Somebody get irritated about.
He's like Torp with a capital T. And every time I see him, I turn red. It's like, it's perfect. Come on, Stephen, shine on my television screen. Okay. So,
what? I have a question.
Point, but of course.
So, you're mentioning is sort of, negative things to embrace as, you know, very, very alive, heated stuff like anger and jealousy.
Sure.
That seems kind of not easier, but when it's more of a confusion or vague deadness, like a, you know, ache, that seems much worse because we actually like anger. I mean, anger is. I mean,
good point. Very good. That's right.
Trump loves being angry, and we love being angry at him. It's like a lively emotion.
It's a lively
thing. The brain really cooks it up,
which is kind of more of that unmoored type of thing.
Yeah. But
unmoored. That's
I'm sorry. What did you say?
He said
unmoored.
Unmoored. Roy Moore.
That was a pun.
That was a pun.
Got it.
I was going to say earlier that perfect confusions me is more like sort of a boat that loses its mooring or something.
Yeah,
like that,
sure.
As opposed to being pulled in different. But I mean, it could be anything.
It could be a lot of things.
So that's my question.
It could be, and the point is, it could be whatever happens to be in your mind.
Oh. What's your question again?
I don't know. I guess you just answered it.
The more subtle, insidious ones are more difficult to work with because it's not quite so apparent.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And in fact, I think there's less of a. For me, I think maybe for other people too, less of a tendency to want to work with the righteous indignation because that feels good. And you can usually find other people that share that.
But what's your name? I forget.
Susan.
Yeah. But that, I'll talk about that a little in a few moments. Okay. Anger specifically. Anger is something that's really available to us, really, in some ways, the easiest one to work with. So teachers tend to use anger more to talk about these things, and people bring it up more. But there's almost any experience we have that has this a confused quality. It can be. I mean, we know when we do self-righteous anger that we're conning ourselves. There's something smelly about it. If there isn't, spend more time with it until it feels until it feels smelly. That kind of stupid place we can go into that can be very cozy but can also be very difficult. We can lean into that and examine that. We can take passion. Passion's tricky. Because passion goes, it can sort of devolve into fantasy, it can devolve into all kinds of things. But eventually that's going to stop working too. So we have a repertoire. And we talk next week about the aspirations of Samanta Bhadra. We'll see that all the stuff that occurs to us that is confused, otherwise known as kleshas, are actually rich with possibility. And the question is, how do we get there? And that's the seeing confusion as the four kayas part. I don't know about you, but I was always baffled with the kayas. And you'll say, oh, Dharma, truth body, and emanation body, joy body. What the hell is this? Okay. And why does it matter to me? Well, it does.
Prove it.
I'm going to. The word kaya means body. But it's not like fleshy body particularly. Kaya is like body, like a body of water. Mm-hmm. It's body like a parliamentary body. So it means a state of being, you could say. But they usually translate it as body, and I was confused by that for years. So
like a dimension.
A dimension is a very good translation.
Yeah.
But it has some kind of definition to it. And the idea of kayas came early in the Buddhist tradition as a means to describe enlightenment, or it means to describe full realization of a Buddha. That a Buddha has a body, but the body has a different feel to it than yours or mine, confused body that we spend so much time maintaining and trying to keep happy. That a Buddha's body has a radiance to it. It is not selfishly maintained, but it sort of emanates for the enlightenment of others. So
could you use manifestation as the word?
Manifestation or embodiment, sure. Absolutely. Well, it's called emanation body.
That's one kaya, but the general kaya means dimension.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't talk about that in terms of the Dharma kaya or Sambhoga kaya. Those are, it's more about space. It's some kind of space.
Yeah, we're going to, yeah. But Sambhoga means enjoyment, or all enjoyment. And that is a little more abstract, a little more ethereal from enlightenment point of view. It's more energetic. It's more vivid. And then there's Dharmakaya, which basically means truth body, which is the highest level of abstraction and inexpressibility. So a Buddha reflects space in corporeal, energetic form.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? The Buddha rejects...
Reflects. Space. It's kind of like Trawa Rinpoche uses the example of a mirror. Look at a mirror. You only see a reflection. What does the mirror look like? We don't know what the mirror looks like. Okay, the mirror doesn't look like anything, but it looks like everything. That's like emptiness. The mirror is a good analogy for emptiness. We can't see the mirror. We can't say what's in the mirror. But you put it, you know, I feel like Rampu. Remember Rampu?
Yes, I remember Rampu.
You know, I see everybody differently, because you're reflecting differently in the mirror. But what the hell does the mirror look like? And that's sort of the three kayas. Then there's kaya number four.
There you go. You got that word right.
Svabhavika. So Elise, what does svabhavika mean?
It's all of it together.
But what does the word mean?
Nothing.
Okay, I was just casting in your direction to see if you knew it. Okay. Svabhava means self. Oneself. It's like reflexive. Or svava, that part. Bhava means born. So it's sort of like self-born or self-arising.
I never knew that.
That's what svabhavika is, self-arising body. And it does combine the whole thing. So there's no difference between an enlightenment body, that kind of energetic quality, and that quality of space. They're all together as one body. Kaya, not corpo, kaya. Okay? This is the most difficult concept we're going to talk about this hour, so I want to make sure everyone's sort of okay.
I have trouble with the word enjoyment body. What does that have to do with anything? Why is it enjoyment? That's a strange word, isn't it?
Is it more about accepting?
That's too conceptual.
It's energetic.
Yeah. It's energetic.
So there's something... But enjoyment, that's...
Enjoyment.
Why is it enjoyment?
He says something about wisdom.
Bliss body. Rainbow light.
It's more abstract.
We talked about bliss before. It's not something that just simply fun.
I think there's analogous there. It's analogous to sukha.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Great bliss. So, yeah. Okay. But not about... So it's sort of... Pleasure and pain together.
Or yes, sort of pleasure and pain together become greater pleasure.
Because you're working with whatever it is.
Exactly, you're open to everything.
You're open to the energy of the universe.
So you can enjoy all kinds of personal misery.
It's the same as accepting.
That sounds Jewish.
This is not Jewish.
Bring your friends.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Hanukkah.
Hang on.
Please.
What's that?
One aspect of svabhavika or enjoyment body is clarity.
We're going to, yep.
And so when we experience clarity, when we have that clarity, we actually find it enjoyable. I mean, we find something delightful in being able to see clearly or to experience things clearly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's before we make a judgment about whether we like or not.
Right,
you know,
right,
it's about that quality of experience or energy that occurs, and the Dharmakaya is beyond concept.
And this is critical in transforming or transmuting our ordinary kleshas or confused emotions into wisdom. It's that clarity aspect.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah. That's Dharmakaya.
That's Sambhogakaya. Okay. Now, seeing confusion this way, it's one thing to talk about Buddha, talk about enlightenment in terms of these four kayas. It sounds very rarefied, but our confusion, the messiness that we experience in our lives, the I don't know what to do, I want this, I want that, I don't want this, but here it comes, oh God, what's going to happen? I don't know, that's what my mind does. Yours may do better things. That mind, that confused mind, has these four kayas. They have Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya is associated with being unborn or unoriginated. That's the mirror that you can't see directly. The Dharmakaya is that which is beyond concept, beyond limitation. And otherwise, we wouldn't be able to think all these damn thoughts. Think of it. If we this is more than pneumonicaya level, but if mind was not the nature of space, it could not accommodate all the things that it can accommodate. So at the beginning, we can tune in to one dimension of our minds. We can do it in meditation. We can do it right now. Is that spacious quality. The Sambhogakaya is just what Michael and Emily were saying. It's that part of our minds that's clear. Now, if it wasn't there, we wouldn't be so inclined to believe in our thoughts. We wouldn't be so inclined to experience our thoughts so immediately and vividly when they occur. If they're gargantuan, big, you know, numero uno thoughts, if there's this, like, you know, subtle thoughts, even a subtle thought which has no energy, but we're there. I was on, like, a solitary retreat. Remember, entire morning meditation, my recitation times, my mind was consumed completely about what I was going to do lunch.
Oh. Yeah, that's happened
okay?
to me, too.
No. And that was just me. It's amazing how we can think all kinds of real stupid stuff. And at that moment, we're there for that. It's like our channel is on that station. Even if it's a home shopping network, even if it's forensic files. So the Sambhogakaya is the clarity, the vividness, the luminosity, the brightness. Even our depressing thoughts, even our gloominess has that quality of vividness. And then there's pneumonicaya, the sheer multiplicity of the whole thing. Do we ever think the same thought twice? I don't know. I have yet to see the reruns.
Oh.
Oh, really? Really? You don't think this?
We cycle through things. But I don't think we have the same thought twice. It has a different place. It does different things. So when we look at our mind, when Khyentse Rinpoche says we analyze our mind, we see our mind as the four kayas. But to do that, we have to be open to that kind of analysis, which is difficult because we do believe in our thoughts and we do refer things to central headquarters. And all we have to do is stop referring things to central headquarters. And the whole thing becomes simple. That the Dharmakaya level is the sheer spaciousness of our minds. The Sambhogakaya level is a vividness, the energy of our minds. The Pneumonicaya is all the stories we tell ourselves that are powered by vividness and by space, but they arise from space itself.
Which is Dharmakaya.
Which is Dharmakaya.
Dharmakaya is giving rise. Appearances are occurring in the Sambhogakaya, and the actual manifestation
is
in the Pneumonicaya. So actually taking it to the Pneumonicaya level. Now, Pneumonicaya refers to actually enlightened dimension of manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just basically, it's like putting a thought into action.
Mm-hmm.
Is like, you know, going to a next step. So do we want to do that, or can we take care of something before we get to that point of actually just putting a thought into action?
Well, that's why this is a slogan.
Exactly.
This is a slogan. This is actually high-level Buddhist realization. But we're using that to help us with adverse circumstances on the path. The adverse circumstances in this case, as Linda asked, is our own mind. So, we'll encounter this slogan when we're all tied up in knots, or when something happens and we just have severely mixed feelings, or we feel in shock about something, or somebody said something to us that we really like or we really don't like, and we feel we've lost our equilibrium a little bit. And so, on or off the cushion, we can click into the spaciousness of whatever it is we're experiencing. That, you know, we know that whatever we experience will change into something else soon enough. So we it's not just that everything changes, but that the fact that everything changes tells us something fundamental about who we are. Linda?
There are 6 points here. Is that just so you can pick one to kind of work with that speaks to you at the time? I mean, it seems to me all you need is number 11.
Number 11 is?
When the world is filled with evil, transform all mistakes into a path of glory.
Because...
So is that so you can kind of... Well, you know, one speaks to you at another time. So
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. These are in your toolbox.
Yeah. Right.
And so, they'll come up at specific times. The situation may necessitate or may call to mind a different slogan. This is particularly good because we get discouraged. We think our confusion is our own. I have been fool enough to think that I possess my own perceptions?
Projections.
Mm-hmm. I've been fool enough to think that I possess my own projections.
That's in the Sadhana Mahamudra.
Right. And so that causes us all kinds. So when we begin to centralize our minds more, maybe that's a time in which the slogan will come up and tell us to let go into the spaciousness, the energetic or clear quality, and the fact that that on a Ramanakaya level, mind is unceasing. It won't stop. If I was on retreat and I decided to have lunch at 2 in the afternoon instead of 12 noon, I'd have 2 more hours of thinking about lunch. And there's all kinds of ways to do that. So, I have, Emily said some time ago that this group loves handouts, so I have a handout for everyone.
A kaya for you and a kaya for you.
Everyone has a kaya. No, we all got 4.
Oh, yeah, 4.
That's actually good.
Yeah, there's another one, but never mind.
Never mind. That has its own potency.
It's not in the slogan.
It's not in the slogan.
Don't worry.
It's not in the test.
Are you going to talk more about how the first part of the slogan relates to the second part, the shunyata protection? Mm-hmm.
We're getting there.
You're getting it, good. Because I
just want to rush it.
I like clarity on that.
Go to the.
I never noticed.
Oh, wait a minute. There's this one here.
Don't pick on Emily.
Don't pick on Emily.
No. Ponder other. Don't bring out my worst trait. I'll do it myself.
Don't talk about injured limbs.
There you go.
We're talking about injured limbs. But what's injured? Is this supposed to be all? Okay.
All right.
This is from Kinsey Rinpoche, who wrote a book called Enlightened Courage on the slogans.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't like the English in some parts of this. The English is a little clunky, so you'll have to bear with it a little bit. If deluded perceptions are understood in terms of the four khayas, it follows that in that which is termed deluded, there is nothing impure, nothing to rid ourselves of. Neither is there something else pure and undefiled to adopt. For indeed, when illusion dissolves, undiluted wisdom is simply present where it always has been.
Okay, why don't we talk about that for a minute?
Say something. This is really important. Fortunately, he goes into detail in the next paragraph.
So, I mean, we're talking about bringing things onto the path of meditation, right? We're talking about experiencing difficult confusion and suffering and prejudice and unbridled passion and anger. But part of what is involved with the path of meditation, which we've been learning about, is looking at where things arise from. Mm-hmm. And if we're actually willing to investigate that, mm-hmm. we're going to move into what we've been talking about in terms of the Dharmakaya.
Mm-hmm. Or the four khayas.
Well, let's start with that. Because okay. Just looking at this okay. in terms of a process of inquiry.
Yep. Yep.
Where do my thoughts come from? Where is this coming from? Just go there. Look into it.
And we find they are unborn.
Okay.
When gold is in the ground, for example, it is blemished and stained, but the nature of gold as such is not susceptible to change. When it is purified by chemicals refined by a goldsmith, its real character increasingly shines forth. In the same way, if we subject the deluded mind to analysis, reach the conclusion that it is free from birth, cessation, and abiding existence, we will discover then and there a wisdom that is undiluted. Furthermore, the deluded mind, being itself illusory, is unstable and fluctuates like experiences in a dream. Whereas the true and undiluted nature of phenomena, the Buddha nature or Tathagatagarbha, has been present from an unoriginated time, is exactly the same in ourselves as in the Buddhas. It is thanks to it that Buddhas are able to bring help to beings, because we all have the same nature. It is thanks to it, too, that beings may attain enlightenment. There is no other introduction to the four khayas than this understanding of the true nature of illusory perception. So, the entire path, you know, we are people who, you know, think that wisdom is there and we're confused people here, or that there's something to achieve or attain. But the Heart Sutra tells us differently. Since there is no attainment, the
Bodhisattvas
abide by means of prajnaparamita. This is prajnaparamita, that ability to find your mind for what it is.
Yeah, can I ask? It may be out of sequence, mm-hmm. I don't know. But so why talk about absolutes compared to relative?
This absolute in the sense that we are looking at the mind from the point of view, we're looking at the mind separate from our relative situation. So we're sort of backing up a little bit, and we're seeing the nature of mind regardless of what it happens to be doing at any particular time. So that becomes that is our avenue into the absolute.
So just as a quick view, one absolute is preconditional, and you could say relative is conditional.
Relative is conditional.
Yeah.
Relative is things are caused by other things.
You said the absolute is preconditioned.
Preconditioned. Yeah, that's very good.
It's beyond conditions are caused.
Unconditioned.
That's very good. Yeah.
Preconditioned before.
There are no preconditions. So those are the four khayas, and it's actually quite liberating. because we can use enlightenment as our path. Because the true nature of our minds, or the true nature of Kensei Rinpoche's mind, of Buddha's mind, and the Karmapa's mind, no different. They all have these four kayas. They all have spaciousness, they all have vividness, they all have multiplicity. And they're tied together as self-arising mind. And this is an important slogan because it's shunyata protection. Okay, I told you I was going to do it. I'm going to do every word.
But does that make sense? People have questions about what that means, how shunyata is actually a protective factor.
Yeah. That's what we have questions.
Oh. Well, that, I mean, isn't it...
Yeah.
Just riffing here. Isn't it because we can... All of our suffering is about grasping and trying mm-hmm. to hold on and make solid. And when we come to the place of realizing with clarity, emptiness, it actually is a great relief.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, whether good or bad, it doesn't matter what it comes into mm-hmm. your...
So what does it protect us from?
Ourself.
I want that.
Could you be a little more specific?
I get a restraining order on myself.
From our confusion.
I know what it protects us from.
What does everybody think here? Huh?
Yeah.
Kathleen said our confusion.
From our need to grasp onto our confusion. Mm-hmm. Need to. Mm-hmm.
I think from being consumed by it. I mean, you can be confused, and then suddenly you see your confusion, a little space. You're still confused, but it's not going to kill you. It's not going to eat you.
Do you notice that it lightens up at all?
Lightens up.
Yeah.
Lightens up. But
that's what we're talking about, lightening up.
Yeah.
We're taking little steps.
Have you ever found that sometimes you hoist the flag of your own confusion?
Yeah.
What, before you see it, you mean?
There are ways in which we take pride in our confusion. We identify with our confusion. Yeah. We find a therapist and we talk about our confusion.
Oh, no, I see.
And we talk more about our confusion. And we make...
There's a great phrase for that.
I'm sorry?
There is one great phrase that I've heard.
Ditta?
Tolerance of ambiguity.
Very good.
That's pretty good.
That's a good beginning. And I know people, and they come to me in my practice, and they're a list of their problems. They have it very neatly sort of all categorized and filed away and stuff like that.
Make them go away.
What's that?
Make them go away. You know, the therapist, make it all go away. That's why Buddhism is so important in any therapeutic practice, I think.
So it protects so what Susan said at the beginning, it protects us from oy vey.
Very important.
It is. It is an important point.
You brought that up.
Third line of Hanukkah.
As a Trolloker says in this book, you invite them in, he talks about some
previous
person.
Oh, these are the four applications.
Give them a cake and tell them the truth.
Right. And that's the four applications follow this. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing doesn't feel too esoteric or too in the clouds. It's like, okay, we are protected from identifying with our confusion. But, you know, still, it's a lot. What can we do to sort of help things along a little bit better? And we can strengthen ourselves in different ways. And accumulating merit is basically acting in virtuous matters that gives us, and the word virtue is the word itself means strength, from the Latin word for manliness.
Oh, take issue with that.
Viral. No, but viral is just a derivative. But vir actually comes from the word. The root word is strength.
Strength. Okay, good. That applies to all of us.
Yes.
Feminine strength, actually.
It's
be precise.
So there's accumulation of merit. There's what they call confession, which is not. I know if you're ex-Catholic, you didn't remember the routine, but it's not that. It's acknowledging your shortcomings and where you've fallen away a little bit. Or it's acknowledging your tendency to make a big deal about your mind. And you acknowledge that, and you can sort of even do it to yourself, it's fine. And, you know, there's practices where you visualize and, you know, you make a sort of a confession of that kind. And Shanti Deva book 2, or chapter 2, has a whole thing about that. Then there's offering cake to... And this is the idea of possession. That it used to be that we thought of mental illness as some kind of supernatural beings inhabiting us. And that's very much the experience that people go through. Even if it's not scientific. That's what, you know, we feel possessed by things. And so in our lives, we can feel possessed by things. And so there are specific rituals, but basically you can, just what you said, you can let these things and offer them some cake and say, okay, you can go away. And we can do it in a kindly way.
What does this mean, though? Let's talk about this for a second, because I think this is really important. It helps just sort of give us a kind of working perspective to work with really unfriendly, difficult situations, is to treat them as guests. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what's actually... When a guest comes into your house, you try to make them feel comfortable for a minute, and just actually make an offering. Mm-hmm. So they can actually get what they need and they can move on,
right?
Because you've made an offering. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a psychological game you play, but it's a way to actually put that factor that seems so possessing mm-hmm. into some kind of a position out there, yes. as it were, as opposed to it's all me, you know.
Right, right.
And so at that point, we have these rituals in Buddhism where we actually do these things of, mm-hmm. you know, inviting everybody as a guest to actually go through this process of making confession and celebrating this fundamental goodness, and then these guests can go away, I mean, mm-hmm. after they've been given these offerings, so that they can actually... move on to their other wherever they're going to go. I mean, are these things out there or not? We don't know. It's not a question of that being the case, but it's a question of actually...
Yeah, stay with our experience. And when we have that feeling that we're being taken over...
I think it's good if we can notice our language, like, and during the day, like, mm-hmm. these things might come. Like I was just thinking of the phrase "out of sorts." Mm-hmm. Nalasa, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bunch of words, out mm-hmm. of sorts. It's like, you know. So I feel like I want to watch for these little phrases because there might be hints in there.
Absolutely.
How we look at these things, where we are possessed, or.
Or I'm not myself.
I'm not myself today.
I'm not myself.
Who are you then?
I'm beside myself.
Yeah, I was exactly. beside myself.
I love that.
That's beautiful.
Because we know exactly what that means.
Beside
and there's almost an artistic, poetic expression.
I'm beside myself with anger.
Mm-hmm. If you beside had myself, then you wouldn't have to be beside it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Out of sorts.
So, the fourth one is asking the protectors to help you. And Buddhism, as you see some of the artwork that Emily has brought in for people, there are some fairly... There are renderings of these very demonic appearing entities called protectors. And but it's like with the third one, the basic idea is that you don't have to carry the whole burden yourself. You can ask your friends to help you. You can talk. I talk to the lineage. You know, I can ask Marfa to help me out. Marfa, I'm kind of a mess today. You would know what to do with this. Or there are sort of a more wrathful energy that simply is, maybe it's just simply in our environment. But it's a skillful means. It's not a metaphysical thing. And some people are going to feel comfortable with that, some people aren't. So you're throwing a lot of things at you so that you can learn how to work with confusion and find your way to the wisdom.
What is it in the Sadhana Mahamudra? It says about the protectors. It's the confused thoughts that have
returned to
nakedness.
Right.
So actually, the confused thoughts themselves become the point of awakening,
right,
of awareness, by actually recognizing the fact that, you know, there's no ultimate existence mm-hmm. in these things that are hounding us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And seeing that is actually a protecting dimension.
I'm having trouble with this one somehow. It seems quite the opposite of drive all blames, taking responsibility or something like that. You were saying it, things would come up and kind of show them the door, make them little offerings and say, okay, bye. You know, aren't they like good food? You would not want to see them go at all.
Well, but you're taking responsibility for it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not blaming other people for your problem.
Right, so you're attending to them by...
Yeah, you're addressing
them. Giving them offerings and sending them off.
Yeah, and it's like we know how much we can handle. And there's no point in trying to be like spiritual athletes with this stuff. That we can, you know, we have a capacity to work with confusion, but we don't have the capacity to work with everything. We're getting there. That's what practice is about. That's what the path is about. And there are times in which it's like, okay, invite it in, take a look at it, and ask it to go away for a while. And that's simple sanity.
I think it's just like with the little kid has these sort of diffuse fears. Mm-hmm. And so you talk about the monster and let's give the monster a cookie or
right.
A million children's books.
Absolutely.
Each other, but now you're not, yeah, it's just like just putting it's actually taking control over it.
Indeed.
But we're not supposed to take control.
But there is a need for containment sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think so. But I just don't know how it fits.
But the moment we talk about boundaries, we're talking
boundaries.
About constantly recognizing and respecting boundaries.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
And so part of certain practices in ritual practices is actually setting up boundaries so you're not just going to be taken over by every stray thought and out of control dynamic that comes under the situation.
Because that fits into psychology. Mm-hmm. That's the way some of this seems on more superficial reading is that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, maybe you'll come to the Sadhana Mahamudra.
The what?
We aren't doing that.
Not next week.
But we'll have to figure out when we can do
that.
But we can
do it sometime.
Oh, we can do it
here
sometime.
We can add it in.
We can actually do it here
sometime.
Sadhana Mahamudra, and it's a way of invoking the wisdom of the wisdom lineages of Buddhism, enlightened lineages, that we can actually practice and enjoy that capacity to experience while we're doing that practice.
And by the way, I was realizing that this whole discussion of the four kayas and the nature of mind, this is called Sutra Mahamudra. Mm-hmm. That this is the same Mahamudra tradition, mm-hmm. but it's on the Mahayana level. So you're getting the real stuff here. We run over a little bit.
The last
one. The last one. Nobody likes completeness, a lot of certainty.
I do.
I have to make sure we've covered all the ground.
Would you like to read the last slogan?
The last slogan is, whatever you meet unexpectedly, join with meditation.
Okay. Things happen unexpectedly. And by meditation, it's wide open what you meet. Simply glance, simply noting maybe the spacious quality, even if it's a, I don't know, if it's a car accident in front of you. It wasn't there once. All of a sudden things happen. Where does it arise from? Obviously, cause and effect. And meditation also means tonglen. So this is sort of a wide open thing that when something unexpected happens to you, join that with some kind of meditative focus, just for an instant. And that's one way of training yourself to convert difficulties into the path so that they reveal a mind that is fundamentally wise. So this stuff is meant to be an encouragement because we cannot avoid our karma. We cannot avoid impermanence. We cannot avoid things falling apart. But we can make them part of our practice and not something different from our practice. There's a tendency sometimes by religious practitioners to sort of isolate, you know, this is godly and this is like, And here we bring the whole thing together into something called sacred world.
I think this is very practical as an instruction, and it makes me remember that time we came to your house for a class. And Michael and I were I was driving, and Michael was with me. We were just going along the road, and all of a sudden, there were two dead bodies in the road on the fast lane. And the motorcycle had hit the obviously they had come in from the side, and then a car, whatever. But the motorcycle hit the Jersey barrier, and there was one guy on the ground and a woman next to him, and they were both dead. And I was. Luckily, I wasn't going very fast, and I wasn't in the left lane, far lane. But it was so immediate. So at first, there's like a shock, and then and it was sort of instant tonglen because there you are.
Sure.
You know, they are in shock. They're dead, but they're still there. I think you know in terms of that shock, so it seems that this is a very potent slogan because we can use it in a lot of different kinds of situations because there are a lot of things that
we encounter.
They could be little or they could be bigger, but that moment is always a potential for awakening. And applying this slogan is, I think, great.
It's immediate.
Immediate.
Your example is a good one. It doesn't mean waiting until you go home and you can light your candle and you can sit down.
No.
There they are. They just died. You knew they just died, and I was right there. I was one of the first cars right after them.
And it really helps on a daily basis to be home, to light your candle, and find a cushion.
Because
it gives you the possibility of
seeing things, and
I think doing tonglen also is not, as we talked about, is not something you only do on a cushion.
No,
of course
you can do it while you're driving a car. Right. Or you can do it while you're washing the dishes.
There was no time to do that here. There was zero time to do it. Emily was driving, and I was sitting next to her. I could see that someone had already. Was on the cell phone on the margin. There was no benefit to our stopping or offering aid. Emily just drove on. I said, Emily, drive. I don't know whether this was helped her. Not too fast, not too slow, but just keep steady.
Yep.
And but I could be doing Tom Lin while I'm driving, yeah. I want you to know. And I was.
Yeah.
So it's and it wasn't the formal practice of Tong Lin, but yeah. you're just yeah. taking right. in the confusion right. or what those right. people are feeling right. in that moment yeah. that, you know, could be me, too.
That's I do that when I'm stuck in traffic. I look around at other drivers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say, they don't want to be here either.
I come up from yeah. New York all the time, right. probably during rush hour.
Oh, no.
And the worst case scenario was a 5-hour drive from New York to here.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, it's so easy to get worked up and completely, you know, energized, exercised. And at the same time, wait a minute, you know, what is everybody else doing? You know, like, you
are they happy? And not? Well,
another thing, I mean, it goes to be grateful to everyone, and with regards to that, like, mm-hmm. yes, traffic mm-hmm. around here can be, yeah. and mm-hmm. But I always, when I can take a pause, and mm-hmm. I can go, well, these people, they're doing me a favor. They're slowing me down because of some accident that's way ahead, or whatever. I mean, right. who knows what, yeah. you know? It's thank you.
Yeah, I was driving up here. I was driving up to Central Mass on Saturday in the snow.
Oh.
And the good news is, while I was in front, I was right back of a snowplow. There were two snowplows next to each other. And I wasn't moving. And that was the good news, and that was the bad news.
Yeah.
I'm glad they were there. And could you, like, let me go? But,
no.
And then it went off an exit. They went off the same exit. It's like, okay, they're out to...
We're the same wavelengths.
They're either out to get me or to help me. Okay.
Yeah.
I think we should end.
Okay.
Now, you will see, by the way, next week how this dovetails so nicely into the aspirations of Samantabhadra.